Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extremely narrow victory that Hillary Clinton eked out over her Democratic rival Bernie Sanders in the Iowa caucus and assess how much of a role the youth vote played in last night's elections and which of the candidates was the beneficiary of it. Sarah Leonard, a senior editor at The Nation and co-author with Bhaskar Sunkara of The Future We Want, Radical Ideas for the New Century, joins us to discuss the political priorities, mood and outlook of the millennial generation and the apparent enthusiasm deficit the Democrats have in the 2016 election races, indicated by the record number of Republican voters who turned out in Iowa that could spell trouble for the Democrats in the general election. Then we'll look into the quirky nature of Iowa's Democratic caucuses, which, unlike the Republican caucuses in which actual votes are cast, operates on headcounts as huddling groups of voters assemble in support of candidates as the clock ticks. We will speak with a veteran of the last several Iowa caucuses, Robert Leonard, the news director for KNIA and KRLS Knoxville and Pella, Iowa, about the razor-thin majority Hillary Clinton won over Bernie Sanders and the fact that some caucus results were decided by a coin toss. Then finally, we will speak with Ken Good, a senior fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress, about President Obama's visit to a mosque in Baltimore scheduled for Wednesday that already has Fox News and the right-wing press trumpeting lies alleging the mosque has extremist ties, ties to al-Qaeda, and ties to radical Islamic groups. We'll examine the difficult job Obama has in trying to assure American Muslims that they and their religion belong in America, while Republican candidates and Fox News drive a wedge between Muslims and the rest of society, the very strategy that the Islamic State is employing. And joining us now is Sarah Leonard, who is a senior editor at The Nation, as well as an editor of the online journals The New Inquiry and Occupy, Scenes from Occupied America. She is the co-author with Bhaskar Sunkara of The Future We Want, Radical Ideas for the New Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Leonard.
Thank you so much.
And I obviously want to talk to you about your book, but also about last night's results in the Iowa caucuses, which have just about only recently been decided, given the cliffhanger between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And it indicates, I mean, I also want to talk to you about the role of the youth vote, if for the want of a better description. But overall, given this record number of Republicans who showed up to vote, does that indicate a enthusiasm deficit, not just amongst young voters, but amongst Democrats in general, that may have dire consequences in the November elections?
Well, I think that this is actually a primary that has generated a fair bit of excitement because there's been the surge from Bernie Sanders, which was totally unexpected. And we have what we thought was going to be a very boring, pre-decided race transformed into at least something more of an exercise in democracy. Iowa is a very tricky measure because it has a very idiosyncratic caucus system that, among other things, means you have to be there at 7 o'clock in line, and if you're not, you can't participate in the caucus, which can go on for many hours as well. So a lot of people who work and can't get off work, parents, actually cannot or have trouble participating in the caucuses. And so it makes turnout in Iowa a very tricky question. So I would attribute some of it to that, because I think that Democrats nationwide are actually surprisingly excited about what we thought would be a fairly tedious primary season.
But why didn't you've given some reasons why they didn't turn out, but enthusiasm, which you've said exists, usually equates with turnout.
Yeah, I think this was not an unusual turnout for Iowa. But that said, I think it might be informative to look at who turned out. And we actually saw a lot of young voters out going for Bernie in a way that was quite startling. He sort of swept that vote in a way that I actually found surprising. We've heard a lot about young people being enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders and a sort of anti-establishment message. But truthfully, I did not expect to see as dramatic a result as was presented in the exit polls, which showed that 84% of voters 17 to 29 voted for Bernie Sanders. And so I think within that demographic, there's definitely a sort of enthusiasm that is catching, and we'll see what that means nationwide. Still, no one expects Bernie to win this primary, but that was certainly a mark of how strong his sort of new base with young people is. It's not like anyone would have identified that as a strong base for Bernie Sanders before this season. So it's very quickly evolving, which is interesting to see.
Well, the results themselves, of course, being as close as they were, they're also a little bit odd. I mean, you mentioned some of the quirks of these Iowa caucuses. On the Republican side, they actually take a vote, but on the Democratic side, they sort of huddle in a kind of way like amoebas, where they break off in little
It's a bit like playing Red Rover for Democracy, yes.
But apparently, according to the Des Moines Register, some of these results were settled by a coin toss, and that sort of leads you to be a little bit skeptical of the results. And that's something that one wonders about, you know.
Oh, yes. Truthfully, we're used to talking about money in politics, but not that way.
Right.
I mean, the idea that you would settle these things by a coin toss is one of the most obviously absurd factors in a very strange primary season. You know, in the U.S., all the states have their own ways of running the primaries. It's incredibly strange. And you could say, in a way, it's an exercise in American democracy where decisions are made at the local level, but certainly it makes it confusing, and some of the methods are not democratic at all. I'm not sure anyone would defend a coin toss as a reasonable expression of democracy. It certainly shows that this was a much, much tighter race than anybody expected. I don't know if anyone who was taking part in these caucuses remembers a time when so many districts were settled by coin toss in recent history. It was that tight, which was stunning.
Right, and of course there's no room or ability to have a recount because there's no paper ballot and you can't recount anything because you can't recreate those huddles of people.
It doesn't really make any sense. The upside of the process is that because the vote was so close, while we can say that Hillary took Iowa, they will probably actually split the delegates. So the outcome of this will be, I think, fairly reasonable. But yes, there is a lot of idiosyncrasy and a lot of arbitrariness built into that caucus system. The upside of it is that people debate face-to-face. It's very participatory. I think people feel good about participating in it because you actually argue with your neighbors about politics in a way that has consequences and isn't just rhetorical, isn't just watching cable news. And I think people actually feel good about that, and Iowans take it extremely seriously. So that is an upside of the caucus system. But yes, it's rife with these sort of idiosyncratic problems. Absolutely.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Leonard, who's a senior editor at The Nation and co-author with Bhaskar Sankara of The Future We Want, Radical Ideas for the New Century. So in terms of your book and the extent to which you're profiling an angry generation and the arrival of a new political left that not only protests but plans, there is, of course, an inescapable connection between what you've written in your book and the person of Bernie Sanders. I mean, is he your spear carrier, your vanguard?
Well, we started working on the book before Bernie Sanders decided to run and before he was any kind of national phenomenon. We actually started working on the project a few years ago, and it meandered forward, as these projects tend to do, especially when they involve a number of different contributors. And we wanted to get different people to write on areas of their actual expertise, such as education, finance, gender, race, the environment. And the reason we wanted to do it was we felt that there was a lot of energy in our generation for change in sort of general terms and a lot of dissatisfaction. People knew what was wrong. You know, Americans have $1 trillion in college debt. Workers under 25 have an 18% unemployment rate. The people most likely to be shot by police are Black 25 to 34-year-olds. You know, things are not looking great for this generation, and we know why. So it seemed important to us to take all that dissatisfaction and channel it towards what we actually wanted, because it seems very unlikely we're going to get what we actually want if we don't figure out how to ask for it and how to plan for it. So we tried to gather some of the voices from this emerging left and put them together towards a positive program. And of course, there's no way that we can dictate the future, nor would we want to. That wouldn't be very democratic in itself. But we wanted to show that this wasn't just some rhetorical exercise, but that we think about politics as something we actually want to win. We actually want to put into practice these things. We're not just unhappy and we hope that some politicians will solve it for us. Because there can be such a thing as a good inside-outside strategy where you have receptive politicians inside and mass movements outside, and that's a way to get progressive change. And certainly we would like for progressive people to be in government. But no one in government and no politician really does anything radical unless they're forced to by large social movements. And so that is really where we think the power lies. And so while we like seeing Bernie Sanders succeed, he is more of a rallying point for all of these ideas and for new people becoming politicized more than he's, you know, the answer to all our problems.
But the anger, the energy that you're profiling here amongst the millennial generation, does it also apply to the right as well as the left? I mean, we're often told that you're the first post-sexual and post-racial generation, and I believe there is some indications that there's, even on the political right amongst the young people, there's more tolerance of same-sex marriage, etc., in spite of the leading candidates, people like Ted Cruz and others, in spite of their hostility to such things.
Yes, absolutely. And there is a difference in demographics between the dissatisfied people voting for Sanders and the dissatisfied people voting on the right. For example, with the Tea Party, which you could see as a precursor to a lot of the trends we're seeing in the Republican Party now, we knew that those people were largely not unemployed people, not usually young people, but sort of middle-aged or middle-career small business owners, people who were not at the very bottom of the socioeconomic chain, but felt that they were slipping. And that was sort of where their dissatisfaction came from, that they had something and they were scared it was being taken away. And those people tended to break toward the right. And what we're seeing on the left with particularly Bernie Sanders supporters are young people who have never known a context in which we could fully say we expected to do better than our parents. You know, these are people who often have done what they were told they should do, which is, you know, go to college, do well in school, save up money, and were not rewarded with a stable career or a type of future that looked promising. And so that disappointment is also very real and very painful, but it tends to break to the left, where there's a dissatisfaction with the politicians who seem to be bought by big business and so forth, and certainly not toward socially conservative politicians.
So is there a sort of natural constituency that includes millennials and their baby boom parents on the left?
A group that would include both of those groups?
Yes, in other words, I'm harking back to the 60s. And, you know, the 60s was, particularly during the Vietnam War, was the last time you had a real political insurrection in this country. And there was a lot of energy and activism on the left, you know, over the Vietnam War, and the extent to which those that were participating in the protests actually had some skin in the game. They were likely to be sent off to die in this futile war. But those people have grown up. Many of them are still maintain some of their anti-establishment attitudes, albeit their drug habits as well. But tell me that if there is any connection there, because I always thought that would be a formidable combination, baby boom parents and their millennial children.
That's a really interesting idea. And I think that we may see some more of that as parents begin to experience themselves what happens when their kids are in debt. Because for every article about how kids are lazy and they all live in their parents' basements and millennials don't know how to work, there are families who understand very concretely the reality of their lives, which is that they try to work and there's very high unemployment. They went to school, but it put them in thousands of dollars of debt. So I do think that families as a whole often see the lie that is presented, often, you know, in a sort of well-meaning way by the media, that instead of dealing with the structural problems in our economy right now, and the politicians who abet that want to look at these sort of soft cultural trends and say that maybe millennials are just too chill to work.
So given the difficulties that millennials are having and trying to figure out the connection between anger and political activism and when that's really going to manifest itself in big numbers and real results, the main thing, going back to the record Republican turnout in Iowa, which indicates the Republicans may well be much more motivated to vote in 2016 than the Democrats. One of the things that's motivating both Republicans and Democrats in this country is this extraordinary and unreasonable fear of terrorism, which pollsters indicate is one of the biggest issues when voters are asked. You know, it's no longer it's the economy stupid, it's, you know, it's the terrorists stupid, or it's the stupidity of being afraid of the terrorists. And frankly, what do you think your generation has to say about that? Are they just as scared as everybody else of this? Because remember, we survived the Cold War for 30 years with a real enemy, the Russians, who could wipe us off the face of the earth. And we're spending 60% more on defense today. And our only threat is a few thousand of these Mad Max marauders driving around in pickup trucks in the deserts of Iraq and Syria.
Well, I think it's safe to say that my generation has grown up with a sort of ambient sense of terrorist threat at all times, because we grew up, you know, around the time of 9/11 and during the George Bush presidency. And so I think that's had two effects. One is that, yes, like some people do internalize that and do feel a fear of the outside. It's much easier to talk about ISIS than it is to talk about the complicated problems that we actually need to solve at home. But I actually think that a lot of young people are very savvy about the way that that threat is deployed these days. And you can actually see that to some degree in young people's support for Bernie Sanders, I think. He plays a lot less on that than other candidates, and I think a lot of people of my generation honestly find that refreshing, because we were just bludgeoned over the head with it by George W. Bush. I mean, it was awful. The color-coded airport signals, all of the sort of ridiculous theater that went along with it, I think we feel a relief to be delivered from that, frankly. That being said, one of the less progressive things about Bernie Sanders is his foreign policy program is not actually very different from anyone else's in the Democratic Party. It's not some sort of radical shift from anything Hillary would do. And so I think that, honestly, foreign policy, terror, that sort of thing has been not really center stage in the Democratic primary. It's been discussed, but it's clearly not the driving issue between Bernie and Hillary. I think it's much more alive right now on the right, and it'll be much more alive in the general.
Well, just in closing, Sarah Leonard, assuming that Hillary Clinton wins, as many predict, although she's not likely to win in New Hampshire, the pundits say she'll probably win in South Carolina and probably Nevada as well. So just going along with that conventional wisdom, it seems to me that the smartest thing that she could do would be to make Bernie Sanders her vice president to keep the millennial generation in the tent. If they've entered the tent in support of Bernie, it doesn't make any sense to, you know, disillusion for to not to keep those in the tent that would otherwise be disillusioned.
That might be smart for her, but I don't think it would be smart for Bernie Sanders. The vice presidency is famously the job in which you do basically nothing and are not allowed to say anything that would embarrass the White House in any way. And I think Bernie Sanders is much more effective in the Senate as an advocate for financial reform. He sits on a number of committees, including Veterans Affairs. And he does a great deal of good work, both for Vermont and the country there, as one of the most left people in the Senate. And while I understand why he would want to take that to the presidency, I cannot imagine why he would want to take that to the vice presidency.
Well, but that, would that mean then that those who's amongst the millennials that support Bernie, will they be disappointed? Will they not show up? Or will they vote for Hillary?
Well, here's what I would say to that. That question comes up a lot. And to me, the value of having people excited by Bernie is that they will go and join the social movements that have created a context in which people are interested in socialism at all. And whether that's Fight for 15, a $15 minimum wage, whether that's Black Lives Matter, those are the groups that create the that sort of force politicians to change their positions, as they already have in this election. Black Lives Matter has forced both Hillary and Bernie to come out with much stronger platforms on reforming the criminal justice system. And so to my mind, that's where change takes place. And I would rather see all of those young people go and work in those movements than just shift to another candidate who is not interested in that type of transformation. I think that would be a much more interesting outcome.
Well, Sarah Leonard, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Leonard, who's a senior editor at The Nation, as well as the editor of the online journals The New Inquiry and Occupy, Scenes from Occupied America. She's the co-author with Bhaskar Sankara of The Future We Want, Radical Ideas for the New Century. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the quirky nature of Iowa's Democratic caucuses. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Leonard, the news director for KNIA and KRLS Knoxville and Pella, Iowa, where he covered the last several Iowa caucuses. He is an anthropologist and author of Yellow Cab, and he has an article at the New York Times, Trust the Iowa Locals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Leonard.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm happy to be here.
And Robert, can you help us out with this cliffhanger between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? We're told, I believe the Des Moines Register said that some of these results were determined by a coin toss. And of course, they were incredibly close. So walk us through why it is that the Democrats have their way of doing things and the Republicans apparently have actual votes so you can actually have a recount. If you're a Republican, but with the Democrats, that's impossible. And as you know, Senator Sanders was a little disturbed about some of the reports last night, lack of Democratic officials at some of the precincts. So what's the nature of this? Is this system on the Democratic side in Iowa as quirky as some are reporting?
It's quirky, yes, indeed. But it's a remarkable, I don't know, almost tribal kind of thing. And you go to the Republican ones are, you know, interesting in and of themselves, but everybody casts their votes and, you know, you learn the outcome and you walk away. But if things are close, I mean, what happens is you go to the Democratic caucus site and you go and you identify who you're going to caucus for. You can, or you can be undecided. And then people make a pitch for whoever. And then you try to convince people to come to your side. And it doesn't always work, but you work it out, you talk, and you extol the merits of your candidate and bring people over. And sometimes it's a tie, and the only way to handle it is with a coin toss.
But in terms of the counting these huddles of people that move around the room, and each people are trying to woo each other to join various circles, I guess it's a bit like watching an amoeba under a microscope go through binary fission. But it doesn't allow for a recount, obviously. And this year, apparently, the counting was done by some Microsoft application. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, Microsoft came out with an application, and Senator Sanders was uncomfortable with that for some reason. I'm not sure from the very beginning, but where the caucus workers just entered the results. And from my end, trying to report on it, it seemed to work seamlessly. They got the results up quick. The website never went down. The Republican website with the results went up and down all night long. My wife is actually she ran one of the caucuses, one of the smaller ones. I think there were about 30 people there. And they did lots of testing with this app on their cell phones. And it seemed to work. We all are used to apps these days, and that's based upon the integrity of the people designing it. I don't think there's any greater problem with the apps that were used in the caucuses than some of the skepticism that we've heard about the Diebold voting machines when it is an actual election. So you have to trust the people building the apps and the machines.
Well, I understand that Bernie Sanders' skepticism or resistance to the Microsoft app for counting was based on the notion that a lot of senior Microsoft executives have given money to Hillary. So I think that's where that came from. But go ahead.
If he's the nominee, then he should be really worried about the Diebold voting machines, because that's the same kind of thing can be said for that. There's been skepticism of them for years. But I understand. I'm not trying to negate his criticism. I guess I just have faith in the system and that we'll get the kinks out and trust the people. And, you know, the Republican and Democratic officials here, I know the directors and leaders, and they're good, honest people. And I'm sure there's been many, many tests.
So having covered the last, three or four Iowa caucuses, Robert, how does this one relate? I was up for hours watching MSNBC last night, and people on the East Coast, of course, were up even later. It seemed to be a bigger media event than perhaps it's been in any other prior year. As we mentioned earlier, it's certainly been the biggest Republican turnout on record. How would you rate this one?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. I just love it. And the people of Iowa take this very seriously. And for once, I tweeted this to somebody I was talking with on Twitter this morning. For once every 4 years, Iowa becomes fly-in country rather than fly-over country. And I don't know, we're delighted with it. We take it very responsibly. I had a 10-year-old girl last night looking over my shoulder, wanting to know results from all over the state. She was very well informed, and she was excited. Our kids get excited. I don't know. There's a lot of people that don't participate, but the ones that do are very well educated and very dedicated to maintaining our first in the nation status.
Well, your piece in the New York Times, though, has a slight bit of sarcasm to it in terms of the difference between the national press and the local press and how candidates treat them. So give us a sense of that, if you will.
Oh, sure. You know, there's some, you know, I'm just a small town radio guy, and some candidates come in and they're, you know, they don't care about the local media. They don't know any difference. All they are aware of are the big national media. They don't know that, well, like, for example, John McCain wasn't interested in going on my program. I was going to give him a chance to talk to me and then my listeners. And, you know, let's say that I have, well, let's just say that only 1,000 people listened to me that day. Maybe if I'm lucky, 4,000. But the 9 people that met him, you know, he met 9 people in a coffee shop. And the thing too is, you know, they told me they don't do small market radio. Lots of campaigns don't do that. But what they don't understand is with the small town radio or newspaper person, they count on us. Our people in our town count on us. There's nobody in my town, I doubt, that reads the Washington Post.
But I believe,
so they can,
yeah. Go ahead.
So they can reach a lot. It's like President Obama, when he was running, he gave us a lot of time. He recognized that local media are very important in our communities. Mitt Romney got it, too. Mike Huckabee got it. I mean, a lot of them get it, but, I mean, Hillary never had time. I got Bernie one question, but I have a 15-minute program. It's, you know what it's like. You want to get in and you want to talk to people. And, I mean, you have your listeners. They know and trust you. You have to build this relationship. And in our town, there's really nobody else that does what we do. We cover city council. We cover, you know, baseball games. We do everything. And people count on us. And so when the presidential candidates come in and don't want to talk to the local media, people want to know why. And they're a little, put off by it. But, you know, this perspective is a little self-serving, too. I love this. I love being a part of it. And I love talking to presidential candidates, and I just get a kick out of them. I'm sort of a political junkie.
Well, then you're in the right state, right? This is ground zero for retail politics. The rest of the country gets nothing compared to what Iowa and New Hampshire get in terms of attention and, handshakes and retail politics. But given what you just told us, Robert Leonard, what was Ted Cruz's recipe for success? What did he do right?
Well, he came and went to every county. He met with a lot of people. His dad came, and his dad is quite a formidable presence and speaker, Rafael Cruz. Ted Cruz was here a lot, and he resonated. I mean, Ted Cruz had a leg up. I was really, there's two different things happening in Iowa. One, we're very progressive in many ways, but we're also, very conservative, and there's a big, big, strong evangelical movement that really identifies with Ted Cruz. And so he just like they did with Rick Santorum last time and Mike Huckabee the time before, they're a very powerful force.
But Dr. Ben Carson is complaining now that Ted Cruz engaged in dirty tricks and told his Carson supporters that Carson was dropping out of the race, and apparently Congressman Steve King, who was a big supporter of Ted Cruz, also tweeted out that Carson was dropping out. So is there anything to that? Is it this that Carson feels that Cruz, that he suffered as a result of Cruz's dirty tricks?
Well, I've looked into this, and I understand Steve King has apologized, but we get so much nonsense thrown at us by, we get so much information, and we're pretty careful about what we listen to. The bottom line with this is Carson ran a lackluster campaign. I attended a couple of rallies for him, and it was just pretty lackluster. No focus on issues. He couldn't even get you know, the evangelical base that seemed to love him, you know, to, you know, really engage compared to the, you know, Ted Cruz was dynamic. Ben Carson wasn't. He left in the middle of the campaign to go on a book tour. He never prepared to talk about issues. Every time he would talk, it'd be his long story about, you know, what a what a bad kid he was, and then he became a great surgeon. And people wanted to hear more than that.
So,
and then, you know, and it's also a little bit of karma, if I don't mind saying. He's supposed to be, you know, Mr. Responsibility, but here he's, you know, he's blaming somebody else for his lack of success. And, you know, this is and blaming somebody else for dirty tricks when this is, you know, this is the guy at a national prayer breakfast that's been bipartisan forever that rose to fame, breaking every rule, every notion of civility by, giving President Barack Obama at this nonpartisan prayer breakfast a really hard time, taking him to task. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for Ben Carson.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Robert Leonard.
Well, thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Leonard, who's the news director for KNIA and KRLS Knoxville and Pella, Iowa. And he also has an article at the New York Times, Trust the Iowa Locals. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into lies being trumpeted by Fox News and the right-wing press about extremist ties to the mosque that Obama is visiting tomorrow. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ken Good, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on civil liberties and terrorism. He was previously a policy analyst at the Center for National Security Studies, where he focused on post-September 11 civil liberties issues. And his latest article at the Center for American Progress is President Obama is Right to Visit Baltimore's Mosque. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Good.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And the president on Wednesday will be visiting the mosque in Baltimore, but already Fox News and other right-wing outlets are trying to associate this mosque with terrorism. And, of course, the whole purpose of the visit, I think, on the part of the president is to actually, you know, dissociate American Muslims from terrorism, since they are being, you know, painted with a broad brush following the San Bernardino shootings. So what do you make of these connections, or these pseudo connections, I guess?
Well, look, I think it's, we need to say that this guilt by association at several steps removed is just ludicrous in the extreme. I mean, if you look back at exactly what it is that they're alleging, it basically is that one now longtime former member of the mosque was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan in the 1970s, but there's certainly no allegation or connection to the organization that isn't at least 45 years old. So that seems to be extremely tenuous at best and laughable in real terms. And then the other allegation is that the Islamic Society of Baltimore is in some way connected with the Holy Land Foundation's prosecution that for funneling some money to Hamas back in 2004, and they're just not connected in any way. So it isn't even as if this particular mosque was discussed in association with that case. It's just not. So the notion here that this is a in any way an extremist outpost is just ludicrous in the extreme, and really, frankly, dangerous to the safety and security of Muslims here in the United States and Americans more broadly, because what this type of activity to try and essentially equate these everyday Muslims with the kind of extremism and barbarity that we're seeing out of ISIS and other terrorist groups abroad, it just breaks down what is just an extremely important and very high barrier between the overwhelming majority of Muslims in the world and these barbarians who are perverting the Muslim faith. And so, I say in the piece that there's this strange convergence of the worldview of ISIS, which tries to present the world as a clash of civilizations between the West and ISIS representing Islam, and these anti-Muslim bigots in the United States and elsewhere that see it in exactly those terms, when nothing could be further from the truth. And so, I'm worried that we're kind of making this casual connection between the most ordinary of mosques in the United States with extremists and doing ISIS's job for them.
Well, you have to pinch yourself, though, Ken Good, and remind yourself that you live in a country where I don't know what the percentage is, but I've heard it's as high as 30% of Americans think that President Obama is a Muslim and was born in Kenya and doesn't have a birth certificate. And a lot of that's been propagated, by the way, by presidential candidates, in particular Donald Trump, who really is the sort of main spear carrier for this birther canard. And when you say in your article, you know, pointing out that Fox News has warned about this mosque that Obama is visiting on Wednesday having extremist ties, the Daily Caller claiming the mosque has deep ties to extremist elements, Breitbart saying it has ties to al-Qaeda, and the Washington Times saying the mosque has ties to radical Islamic groups. It's just a mantra, but it's a very familiar mantra from all of these presidential candidates, just about. They're all, you know, basically spreading this paranoia. And the thing that I can't for the life of me understand is how none of them seem to understand that in the war on terror, for want of a better description, there's no way in the world that a Christian or a Jew can dissuade a Muslim from taking a radical path. The only person who can do that is somebody that shares them and is a fellow Muslim and can dissuade this person from taking this path that is a corruption of the faith. So, in other words, as far as I'm concerned, American Muslims are at the front line of our defense against radical Islamic terrorists.
Yeah, they certainly can be. And you know, it is ISIS's explicit strategy to try and polarize Western societies and provoke a backlash in those societies against the Muslims that live there in order to try and push those Muslims towards ISIS. And here we have another example of people in the United States essentially doing ISIS's job for it by trying to associate this everyday mosque in the city of Baltimore, a mosque I will note that has been the subject of real threats on the safety and security of the people who worship there just in the last year, and trying to associate this group with extremists abroad and trying to present it as some kind of fifth column here in the United States that is seeking to do Americans harm when nothing could be further from the truth. And they're doing it for reasons that are, I guess, somewhat partisan political and trying to oppose the president or trying to gin up some kind of hysteria that will push their presidential candidate over the line in November of this year. But that is just so incredibly short-sighted, and how, you know, what we're going to be facing in the aftermath of such a situation, whether it's Donald Trump as the nominee or Ted Cruz as the nominee, or really any of the Republican nominees who have not stood up to this in any way.
In contrast to Senator McCain, when he was running for the president back in 2008, a woman accused Obama of being a Muslim, and Senator McCain corrected her and said, no, he's a good Christian. So that's sorely lacking in this particular field.
And Mitt Romney did the same, you know, multiple times, and that was really kind of a theme and a feature of their campaign. Now, certainly there were elements that were pushing these views, you know, have been, you know, ever since Barack Obama became a candidate for president. But there was a concerted effort on the part of responsible figures in the Republican Party to push this down. And now we've seen just a total flip of that, where they seem to be elevating it at every opportunity.
So let's talk a little bit about the last night's results in Iowa in terms of national security, which is your beat, Ken. And what was your sense that, I mean, the guy that wants to carpet bomb the Islamic State won, of course, Ted Cruz. The guy that's tied in with the neocons, who are looking for another war or several wars if they can find them, Marco Rubio, acted as though he won when in fact he came in third. But apparently the establishment is very happy about that prospect of him being resurrected. And of course the big blowhard at the top was beaten. And I don't know whether that's the beginning of the bursting of his bubble or not. But so let's go through the candidates in terms of your sense of their national security policies and what they might portend.
Sure. You know, like, I think that when you look at these three candidates in particular, you know, there is a diversity of view on foreign and security policy that we haven't necessarily seen in a lot of Republican election campaigns over the last, you know, decade or so. But one thing that ties them all together is just an overwhelming sense of recklessness on the policies that they propose, whether it's Rubio's more traditional neoconservative, every world problem can be solved by the United States military in a large ground invasion, or Donald Trump's just what we're going to do is build as many walls as we possibly can and shut out all the people that basically aren't white Christian Americans, or Ted Cruz, who seems proud at the notion of bombing the sand in the Middle East until it glows. None of those, none of them I would feel comfortable with in the Oval Office, trying to direct the United States in what is a challenging global security environment. And the reason why is fundamentally they're all reckless. I think there is this battle going on between principally Senators Rubio and Cruz over whether the United States is going to be an aggressive military power in the Middle East through the air or on the ground. But there isn't any reticence or drawback in the approach that either of them would take. And then it's impossible to predict what a President Trump would do in any particular national security situation, but calm regard is probably not going to be particularly high on the list in how he manages those situations. So they're all reckless and they're all deeply worrying.
But one of the indications from these results in Iowa on the Republican side, I think, has great implications for the general election, or at least it seems to, and that is that the turnout for Republicans in Iowa was an all-time record. So I think this year Republicans are very motivated, in large part by all of this paranoia being ginned up by their presidential campaigns and the constant mantra that Obama has somehow sold out America and made us weak, and if not, in fact, being himself a traitor to America. So that's the kind of environment that this paranoia is being ginned up in. But what do you think is going to happen then in terms of the Democrats, whether it's Sanders or Clinton, in terms of having to fight this battle in a general election environment where paranoia rules and reason is hard to find?
Look, I think it's clear that Democrats face an enthusiasm gap with Republicans so far in this presidential election campaign. Now, some of that can be attributed to the circus atmosphere brought to the campaign by Donald Trump, and whether or not he has the staying power to fight back after his first real defeat, his first real moment of adversity in this campaign remains to be seen. But even if it isn't Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, there is will be a wave of energy backing whoever sits atop that ticket, and the Democrats do have to find a way to energize their supporters to come out and match the kind of enthusiasm that we're seeing on the Republican side. And another challenge that Democrats have is that national security issues are front and center in the Republican campaign, and they are certainly taking a back seat, so far at least, in the Democratic primary campaign. And when we look at the broader electorate, the broader electorate as a whole is more concerned about national security issues than the Democratic electorate is. And so we're kind of facing a little bit of a challenge in that as well, as when we emerge from this primary battle, whoever is the nominee, and I think the results yesterday, while extremely, extremely tight, still probably favors Hillary Clinton in the long run. Whoever the nominee is going to have to find a way to pivot to the national security question and be responsive to some of these lines that the Republicans are taking.
But do you think that either of the two Democratic candidates would actually, you know, take on the American people in the sense that that's where the problem lies, in the extent to which here we are, the world's lone superpower, the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. We spend 60% more on defense than we spent during the Cold War, when we had a real enemy in the Soviet Union that could have actually wiped us off the face of the map. And yet we are quaking in our boots over a bunch of Mad Max marauders driving around in pickup trucks in the deserts of Iraq and Syria. And all the Republican mantra is always, it says, to particularly to Obama, is it's time for you to man up, or you're not manning up. And me, Ted Cruz, I'm a red-blooded American, and I'll bomb them until the sand glows, as you referenced one of his statements earlier. So my sense is that what is needed here is for the Democratic candidate to say it's not a question of manning up, it's a question of growing up. You know, we are not that threatened. We are not threatened, you know, or even to pick up on what President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Yeah, this climate of fear is certainly something that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to have to push back on. Interestingly, I think the challenge of trying to reassure the American people in these moments of anxiety requires a much more aggressive public posture than you would normally think when your message is, let's keep calm and carry on. And so, you know, that is one of the areas where it's been difficult for Democrats to get that message out and across, given the focus of their campaign. The primary campaign so far has largely been on domestic and economic policy issues, while all of the oxygen in the national security debate and conversation is in this fear-mongering and hysteria coming from the other side. So once the Democratic primary is over, or even as we start to get into more and more actual primaries and caucuses and the votes are being tallied, Democrats are going to have to pivot more to address this national security question and address this fear and hysteria that's kind of sweeping some of the electorate. and present a reassuring message, but that message has to be presented frequently. It has to be presented aggressively and with the same level of energy that the Republicans are driving, if not more energy than the Republicans are driving on the fear.
Well, Marco Rubio, of course, is repeating the neocon playbook, and the neocons have always primarily, I think, been shills for the military-industrial complex. I mean, they dress up their military doctrine in all kinds of patriotic and fanciful pronouncements. But at the end of the day, they're really all about shaking the American people down for more and more defense dollars. And now here you've got Marco Rubio saying, you know, our president is, our military is at an all-time low, we've never been weaker, and all of this sort of nonsense. I mean, maybe I'm asking for too much for reason to prevail over hysteria, but, you know, is there any way for the facts to speak for themselves?
They won't speak for themselves. And that, I think, is the key challenge that Democrats have in this environment, is that there is a real difference between being safe and feeling safe. There is a real challenge in an environment of hysteria and fear that, you know, the logical arguments just don't measure up to those being pushed on the other side. And so that's why, you know, I think one of the real problems that we face in this primary campaign is the disparate attention that's being paid to national security in the two primary elections. And so that's why, you know, I hope that both candidates, both Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders, start talking about their visions on foreign and security policy more, and start really trying to push back on what is just basically Republicans pushing on an open door on this question, because the facts won't speak for themselves. You know, they need to be made; those messages need to be out there. They need to be said often, and they need to be, these arguments that Republicans are making need to be met aggressively.
Well, just in closing, though, Ken Gude, of course, if this message were to get out that the reality is that we are safe and we are strong and nobody really threatens us, then, of course, if some, you know, minor terrorist attack kills a couple of people in this country, that completely blows it away. So that must be one of the things that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are afraid of, aren't they? That you start reassuring too much and then something blows up in your face.
Well, I think there's a difference between a message of complacency and a message of resilience. And how we can present an image of the United States as a strong and resilient country capable of meeting the challenges and the threats that we face is one thing. And then there is one in which we try to minimize the threats, and that's different. Hillary often talks about choosing resolve over fear, and that's the kind of message that we need to be getting consistently out there, not one that tries to say that there is no threat, but one that says that we are strong enough to deal with it.
Well, Ken Gude, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Ken Gude, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress, where he has an article, President Obama is Right to Visit Baltimore Mosque. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.